The Tom Woods Show, episode 1402.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, this episode is brought to you by Policy Genius. No matter how much or how little you know about life insurance, you can find the right policy in minutes at policygenius.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I want to spend a little time today digging a little bit deeper into something I asked about and question I raised back on episode 1399 with Dan Mahler. I was asking, why aren't we more popular given that our ideas seem to be in line with the basic moral ideas that are taught to everybody? Why aren't we the great heroes of America and the world and instead despised? How can that be? What is happening here? What's the disconnect that's going on? So to follow up on that, I wanted to deal with one of the objections that is somewhat related to that, that we actually get from the other side. They'll say to us, well, if you guys are indeed as good as you say, and your ideas are as good as you say they are, why aren't they implemented on a large scale? I mean, obviously, some things that we teach and believe in are indeed implemented around the world. I mean, there are stock markets, so there is private property in the means of production. There isn't surveillance of every aspect of your life in every single country. I mean, so in other words, we have some victories somewhere. But their point is, why is there no purely libertarian country? So I don't know if you've heard that objection, but I sure get it. I've seen it a number of times. It was in Salon a number of years ago. Michael Lind had a piece. It might have been Slate, actually. I don't remember. Who even cares, right? But they were asking that sort of question. If libertarianism is so great, why can't you point to any actual countries? That's such an odd way to ask it. I mean, the communists thought communism was great. And does the fact that they could actually point to communist countries mean communism is better than libertarianism? I think the world would be a lot happier if those people couldn't point to any countries, you know, implementing their ideas. So the fact that they could point to some countries, how does that make it better? How does that, I don't get that, right? Yeah, the fascists could point to some fascist countries. Does that make them better? What a strange calculus. But on the other hand, I can at least get if this person were really a sincere seeker after the truth, who genuinely want to know why aren't there any libertarian countries, I'm perfectly willing to consider that, but that's not what was happening with Michael Lind when a number of years ago he did pose this question online. So I actually wrote this up a while ago. It was Michael Lind and then E.J. Dionne from the Washington Post, who basically said more or less the same kind of stuff. So I came back with, against Lind, I had 9 responses, okay? And the 9 responses are all snarky and kind of sarcastic. But the point is, I'm trying to show how if you reword his question, it really does answer itself. So for example, if they're going to say, if libertarianism is so good, why aren't there any libertarian countries? Then I can just as easily come back and say, well, if libertarianism is so good, why doesn't local law enforcement want to give up the money, supplies, and authority that come from the drug war? Okay, you see? So whether the idea is good or not, the point is there are entrenched interests that want to maintain their little fiefdoms. Suppose he asked us this way. If libertarianism is so great, how come big financial firms would rather get bailouts instead of standing or falling on their own merits? Why would they prefer bailouts? So again, libertarianism can be a fine idea, but people feel like they can benefit in the short term by asking for state benefits. What's surprising about that? And those people organize and put a lot of effort and money into getting state benefits. This is in no way a judgment on libertarianism. It's a judgment on human nature that people want to act this way. So again, another one I have is, if libertarianism is so great, how come people would rather earn a living by special privilege rather than honest production? Yeah, you see? I mean, that's really what you're asking. Why aren't there any libertarian countries? Well, it's because a lot of these things, because there are vested interests who would rather get benefits from the state. They would rather, I mean, remember Albert J. Nock's point that people want to achieve their ends with the least possible exertion. And that's why the state is such a temptation, because it seems like an instrument by which you can achieve your ends with relatively little exertion, because the state will just give you the stuff. Likewise, you've got the military-industrial complex, and it likes the revolving door arrangement that it has, and it's got its strategy of fleecing the taxpayers with different kinds of tactics that I've described in the past. So it's not any kind of knock against libertarianism to say, well, you know, look, if libertarianism was so great, how come there's a military-industrial complex, you know, sucking the life out of the taxpayers? Well, because they would rather do that than be libertarians. That's all. That's all. How come businessmen often prefer subsidies and special privileges? I mean, you may as well just ask that question. That's exactly the same question as, why aren't there any libertarian countries? You could also ask that question as, how come businessmen sometimes prefer subsidies and special privileges? You could ask, how come some people prefer to achieve their ends through war rather than peace? You know, that also hits at, why aren't there libertarian countries? Because there are people who think they will be better off if they use violence. How is that a strike against our point of view? It just means it's going to be more difficult for us to get it implemented, but it's certainly no strike against us. And then, of course, you can't forget the elephant in the living room here, which is, it's not like people are presented with our ideas and statist ideas, and then they just impartially evaluate them. They really never hear ideas, or if they do, they hear them in ridiculous caricature. They're certainly not getting them in K-12 education or in college. They're getting the opposite. And I know that because, you know, we've all gone through this process, most of us. It's no secret. But also because I talk to people who are anti-libertarian, and I don't even recognize my views in what they're saying. Whereas if I described their views to them, they would say, yeah, that's what I believe, and that's why I believe it. But the things they say about us and why we believe the things we do, it's so cartoonish. They've never actually heard it. So how are they supposed to evaluate it? Now, that's not to say that we'd have a majority of libertarians in America if only we could get the word out, but we'd certainly have a heck of a lot more. Well, E.J. Dionne gave a different answer about why there isn't. I mean, Lind just posed it as a rhetorical question, but why isn't there a libertarian country? And why don't we have libertarianism in America? And Dionne says, well, it's basically because we tried it and we decided we hated it. He says, we had something close to a small government libertarian utopia in the late 19th century, and we decided it didn't work. We realized that many would never be able to save enough for retirement, and later that most of them would be unable to afford health insurance in old age. Smaller government meant that too many people were poor and that monopolies were formed too easily. And when the Depression engulfed us, government was helpless, largely handcuffed by this anti-government ideology until Franklin Roosevelt came along. All right. Well, as a longtime listener of the Tom Woods Show, you know every aspect of that statement is false. First of all, in the 19th century, there was no such thing as retirement. Nobody in the 19th century thought, when I turn 65, I'm just not going to do anything anymore. So nobody in the 19th century was saying, under this terrible system, people can't save enough for retirement. Nobody spoke that way. So the only way the economy could become physically productive enough for something like retirement even to become conceivable, you had to have continued capital accumulation. You had to have businesses able to reinvest their profits in the purchase of capital goods, the goods that make the production process more productive. That is to say, we get a greater abundance of consumer goods. And even when Social Security was established, the retirement age was higher than the existing average life expectancy, which meant that most people would be dead before they could get any of their money back. And then health insurance in old age. People won't be able to afford health insurance in their old age. Well, for this, really, first of all, you should read my free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Healthcare. That's a good one. That's at yourfriendsarewrong.com. I mean, just for the pure satisfaction of typing yourfriendsarewrong.com into your browser, you should do that. Because we go in that book and get in great detail as to what's causing the high costs and what can be done to fix it. But let's also remember, and this is something that historian Alan Mattisau wrote, most of the government's medical payments on behalf of the poor compensated doctors and hospitals for services once rendered free of charge or at reduced prices. Medicare, Medicaid then, primarily transferred income from middle-class taxpayers to middle-class healthcare professionals. And of course, what made healthcare so costly? It was not the free market. So I recommend that ebook for sure. You're going to thank me for that. Or you're going to, I don't know, you'll just be glad. Maybe you won't literally thank me. If you feel like thanking me, You can go to tomwoods.com and contact me there. As Homer Simpson once said, I like being thanked. All right, folks, I'm going to interrupt myself for just a minute. I have, in my life, come across numerous tragic situations. Something unexpected happens, and a husband passes away, and he leaves behind a family for which he has not made any life insurance provision. And it's horrible. You just can't do that. If you have not gotten yourself life insurance, you've got to do that today. That's just what a responsible person does. And I am glad to tell you that it's not hard to do. Policy Genius makes it easy to get financial security for your family. In just 2 minutes, you can be comparing quotes from top insurers to find your best price. And once you apply, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork and the red tape. No commissions, no hidden fees, just financial protection and peace of mind, no strings attached. It could not be an easier process. I've used it myself. And Policy Genius doesn't simplify just life insurance. They also make it easy to compare and buy home insurance, auto insurance, and disability insurance. So again, listen to me. Sometime today, if you haven't done this yet, pull out your phone and head to policygenius.com. Policy Genius. Spring is here. Kick it off by nipping life insurance in the bud. All right, let's go on. Remember his next statement. Smaller government meant too many people were poor. Now, this is just flat out idiocy. I don't know how else to describe it. I'm probably supposed to be nicer than that. I can't do it. The greatest gains against poverty in the United States came when the government was basically not involved. In 1900, the poverty rate, by today's standards, was about 95%, by today's standards. By the time the federal government got involved in poverty relief in any non-trivial way in the late 1960s, that figure had already come all the way down to between 12 and 14%, where it has remained to this day. So it came down with very, very little welfare state to speak of. And then it stagnates as soon as the government gets involved. Now, imagine if it had been the opposite. Let's say it stagnated under the free market, and then government gets involved and it plummets. Well, we'd never hear the end of that. You stupid free market people, you can't conquer poverty. Thank goodness the government got involved. But the exact opposite is the truth, which is why no one ever hears about this. Then we get told that smaller government meant that monopolies were formed too easily. And that's why we all decided we can't have small government. Here, Dion is just relying more on his recollections from eighth grade than he is on actual data on the subject. And as you've heard me say before, the guy on this who's done such great empirical work is Tom DiLorenzo. And it really began with a 1985 article he wrote in the International Review of Law and Economics. And what he reported in there was that during the 1880s, when real GDP rose 24%, output in the industries that were alleged to be monopolized, industries for which there was available data, that is, rose 175% in real terms. And one of the characteristics in neoclassical monopoly theory of a monopoly is that it restricts output. But actually, we see output is rising much faster in the allegedly monopolized industries. And then prices are supposed to be rising. That's the other thing that qualifies something as a monopoly. But prices in those industries were generally falling, and falling even faster than prices were falling in the rest of the economy. Steel rails fell from $68 to $32 a ton during the 1880s. Zinc fell 20% during the 1880s. Refined sugar, 22%. This pattern held true for all 17 supposedly monopolized industries, with the trivial exceptions of castor oil and matches. Finally, we read this. When the Great Depression engulfed us, government was helpless, largely handcuffed by this anti-government ideology until Franklin Roosevelt came along. All right, so Dion is just repeating the Hoover believed in laissez-faire myth. Historians, even regular historians, rejected that one a long time ago. I mean, Rothbard was way out in front on that. But even at PBS.org, PBS, public television, PBS.org, I read this. Historians now acknowledge Hoover's progressive inclinations and his commitment to counter-cyclical planning and the belief that the nation ought to have a reservoir of big projects in the planning stages that could be executed when the time was right. Programs begun during the Hoover years, such as the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, were forerunners of the New Deal, and years later, New Dealer Rexford Tugwell acknowledged that, even though no one would say so at the time, quote, practically the whole New Deal was extrapolated from programs that Hoover started, unquote. So that last bit was from Tugwell, but the whole passage is a scholar at PBS.org. I mean, Hoover himself said flat out, laissez-faire is a thing of the past. He said that as Commerce Secretary all through the 1920s. He launched public works projects, he raised taxes, he extended emergency loans to failing firms, he hobbled international trade, he lent money to the states for relief programs. He was trying to prop up wages at a time when prices were falling. So that obviously contributes to unemployment. His deficits as a percentage of GDP rivaled Franklin Roosevelt's. So much for we were handcuffed by this stupid laissez-faire ideology until FDR came along. I mean, that's, come on now. So we're told that government can help if it's not handcuffed by laissez-faire thinking. But the government was not handcuffed under Hoover or FDR, and yet the Great Depression persisted longer than any economic downturn in U.S. history. Now again, imagine if that were reversed. Imagine if in the longest economic downturn in U.S. history, there had been no government involvement at all. We would never hear the end of it. Ah, that goes to show why you need the government involved. But when the opposite is the case, when you have the longest economic downturn in U.S. history and the government's fingerprints are all over it, and the government can't keep its hands off it, you never get them saying, well, I guess that goes to show government doesn't work. They either don't tell you about the results, they just leave you to guess that things must have gotten better, because that's how Dion does it. He just leaves you to guess that I guess FDR must have solved that problem. Or they'll just say, well, I guess we needed more government involvement. It never makes them question the whole approach, the whole way of thinking. And then note the language he uses about the Great Depression. The Great Depression came along, right? It just came along. It had no real cause. It just came along. So there's no Federal Reserve mentioned here. There's no credit expansion in the 1920s. It just came along, you know? Who knows where these things come from, you know? Well, let's all act like nobody knows that they're always preceded by Federal Reserve credit expansion. I mean, let's pretend we haven't seen that again and again and again. In short, what we have here is a guy who at the Washington Post has a huge audience, and he's repeating like half a dozen preposterous claims, pro-government myths, in just one article. And this is read, this is the newspaper of record, this is read by a ton of people. And then he presents the question of why people aren't more sympathetic to libertarianism as if it were some kind of puzzle. Well, if it's a puzzle, then E.J. Dion and his friends are rather a big piece of that puzzle. All right, folks, a shorter episode today, but we went crazy long yesterday with Gene Epstein, and I realize you have only so much time to be listening every week, so we're doing a shorter one today. But I do want to tell you, I've got a big backlog right now I've got to get through of folks who have started websites through my link, and this one is going to resonate with a lot of you folks because I know that when I do episodes on this, they get a big response. This is a fellow named John Douglas Brandt, B-R-A-N-D-T. And what he's got is a site on not just his personal story, but things that he's learned from it, what you can learn from it, and what you ought to be doing. He is a college dropout over 2 years ago, and he just decided to work in the field he was majoring in. And the site aims to show people how they can build a debt-free and even degree-free career without wasting productive years. And he says that obviously we see tuition prices skyrocketing. We have over 115,000 janitors who have a bachelor's degree. Something's screwy here. So he's got free daily tips about building a successful career without a degree. It's over at johndouglasbrandt.com. J-O-H-N-D-O-U-G-L-A-S-B-R-A-N-D-T. johndouglasbrandt.com. You can also check out his many dozens of blog posts on this subject. Definitely worth checking out. I'll link to it also at tomwoods.com/1402, the show notes page for today. And remember here, the secret is go to tomwoods.com/publicity to find out how, if you get your hosting through my link, you can get nice publicity from me, get some traffic to your site, plus some tutorials from me and membership in my private bloggers group where we engage in mutual help because there will be things you'll need help on. So a lot of nice bonuses when you get your hosting through my link, and you get a great price on the hosting too. So it's a win for everybody. So tomwoods.com/publicity is how to get all that, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.